Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Handling the Heat, the podcast by restaurantequipment.biz, where we dive into the real stories behind the people powering the food service industry. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dana Strauss, partnerships lead at Table 22, a hospitality technology platform that helps restaurants and specialty retailers grow customer loyalty through subscription-based memberships. Dana has a very dynamic career journey in food, from consulting in Washington, D.C., to writing for a local food blog, staging at Michelin-starred restaurants, going through culinary school, and eventually moving into the world of food tech. We dive into what she learned at every stage of that path, how technology is shaping the way people experience restaurants, and why loyalty and community are more important than ever in the food industry. We also dive into Dana's current work at Table 22, where she helps places like Sarma in Boston, Fish Cheeks in New York, and Rose's Luxury in DC build subscription programs that turn casual customers into lifelong fans. Let's welcome Dana to the show. Dana, thank you so much for joining us here on Handling the Heat. Super excited to chat with you about your food journey.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. It's really exciting to be here.
So one of the things that we ask everybody, Dana, before we get started with the interview is what's something you've eaten recently that you've really enjoyed?
Ooh, I love this question because I'm eating all the time. Okay, I think the best thing I ate recently was the squid ribbons at a restaurant that I cannot fully pronounce. I don't know if it's like Chiquito or Tixito in like North Chelsea. It's like a Basque restaurant, one of like the best Spanish wine lists and great like pinchos tapas bars in New York City, I think. But this is like one of the most unique dishes I've ever had. The like texture is incredible. The flavor is incredible. Like run to Chiquito, Tixito, however you say it.
To get some squid ribbons.
To get squid ribbons, you must. It is like non-negotiable. Yes, you have to.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for taking the time. We've had the opportunity to chat a little bit outside the podcast. And I think your story is interesting because it's rooted in this passion for food, but you've touched a lot of different parts of the business, whether that be media, more operational kind of corporate side of things, or, you know, in your position now at Table 22, working directly with restaurants and helping them build up their loyalty programs. But can you start us a little bit at the beginning and talk about Dana, fresh out of college, getting into a more corporate kind of world in DC, and how you found yourself working through some food-related jobs, both in your day job and your post-day job?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think like my path is interesting in that like I've always worn like 100 hats and always like felt like I could always take on more, and I never said no to anything, and that's probably why. As you'll all learn, I've done so many different things, but I think I just knew I wanted to be around food in some way. I knew I wanted to be in a world that also helped people, and whether it's through sustainability or like community, in some capacity, I wanted to do something meaningful and important. And I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I just did something that was like just food related or like just serving fine dining. So I was like a food and sustainability major in college, and I went on to do some food service consulting in Washington, D.C. And what that job really entailed was managing the large food service contracts at like a dining hall or in a stadium. So like the concessions, your meal plan when you're a freshman, junior, senior, sophomore, et cetera. Basically building financial models, helping schools, you know, figure out their plate cost and what they should really be serving students. And I didn't really realize, I realize now, but I didn't realize then how valuable that was. And at the end of the day, it just felt like hot dogs and hamburgers. And I knew right. I was cut out for more. While I was working there, I like needed a creative outlet. I like was drooling for something culturally significant. So I started working for like a local food blog called Bitches Who Brunch, which is a hilarious name now and not very aligned with like probably who I am as a person or on my socials. But we ate out a lot and basically gave reviews of the local restaurant scene before, way before, you know, influencers and creators were doing food reviews, which was a cool thing to do.
How did you, I think what's interesting about people who go back and forth, right, where they have a day job and then have their creative outlet separately, is it's difficult to keep the line in the sand, right? Where it's like, this is who I am in a consulting world. This is who I am from an editing kind of content creation, although it probably wasn't called that back. It was more like media development. How did you keep your feet on both sides of that going from consulting back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't is the answer. My head was like never in my consulting job. If anyone like from my consulting firm is listening to this, they were like, absolutely, she was the weakest link. Like, this makes a lot of sense. which ended up not being true. Like, I think I was there for 3 years, and at the end of my third year, it definitely clicked for me. And I like, you know, this is my first job. I had a lot of growing pains. But I think to start, like, my head was like in Bon Appetit magazine listening to like Adam Rappaport on his Bon Appetit podcast and Amanda Shapiro and all of these food creators from like the early days of Bon Appetit. And by early days, I just mean like early days for me. I know it's existed for a long time, but kind of its peak of like this like sexy food thing that I couldn't stop thinking about, but I like knew I needed to like make money and like be an adult that went to college. So I like felt like I had to do both, you know. One for my sanity, but one for society.
And what was the leap from this is aspirational to, all right, I need to, you know, roll my sleeves up and really get into the weeds here?
Yeah. So I knew that, like, I dreamt of being like an Adam Shapiro, I mean, an Adam Rappaport and Amanda Shapiro, somebody on like the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen team or like a restaurateur. Like, I spent my days dreaming about this. And I was like, well, if I'm going to like dream about this, I have to like experiment what it actually feels like in real time. Otherwise, this is like a waste of thought. And so I sought out to work in a restaurant locally in Washington, D.C. And you know, I'm not the type of person that like does something lightly. Like, when I do something, I'm kind of extreme about it. So if I was going to work at a restaurant, it had to be the best one. So I started working at a restaurant called Little Pearl, which is part of Rose's Luxury. Rose's Luxury is a Michelin star restaurant in the district. They own, Aaron Silverman is the restaurateur who owns that group. He owns three restaurants. All of them have Michelin stars. And I started in the kitchen as a stage, like, you know, a couple times, basically like learning how to like plate like the most delicate of things and really being like scared shitless to like touch anything, but knowing I like needed to send things out of the kitchen, which was like the scariest thing in the world. And after I did that a few times, you know, I was like, okay, I think this is really cool. And this is like what I need to explore a little bit further. So I literally like walked into my consulting firm, walked into the vice president's office and was like, I need to do something else. And obviously I cried and was like, I'm sorry to have failed you. But quit cold turkey and started like a couple days later at Little Pearl, basically doing whatever they needed me to do. I was like a runner. I was like working the host stand. I was working in the kitchen. Like, I did whatever they needed me to do, essentially.
Was the desire this like lifestyle, or was it the content itself? Like, not content in terms of media, but content in terms of like food. Like, what was the put? Because that's a huge jump to go from I need to have the standard post-collegiate job to, all right, let me, you know, clean out the bathrooms. That it's a very nice restaurant, but you know, there's some very not nice jobs that need to be done.
Oh yeah. And I love this question, Zach, because I think now I like mentor a lot of people who want to dive into culinary or into food or restaurants, and they tell me what they're interested in, and I ask them what the dream is. And most of the time they never want to get their hands dirty. They really want the lifestyle that comes with, like, whether it's the creator lifestyle and just they want to eat a lot of free food, or, you know, they want to like have a great following. And for me, I think part of it was the lifestyle in that I really wanted to feel important. I really wanted to feel like I was like contributing. And that's like the itch I wanted to scratch at a restaurant. I knew I would be good at it. But I think I really just wanted to learn. I think that was like the biggest thing that I wanted to do. And I knew like I could learn fast. And so that's why I went like straight to this restaurant group. And I ended up learning a lot about food, a lot about wine. I took my level one sommelier exam through the restaurant. They like paid for me to do that, which I was fortunate enough to be able to do. So just like exposure to these opportunities that I probably wouldn't have gotten if I was just like staying at my consulting job and kind of playing it safe.
Do you think, because I've talked to a couple of people who have gone back and forth between more corporate jobs within and around the food space, and then obviously the operational jobs that, you know, spreadsheets don't matter if the food's bad kind of thing. But do you think your experience working on these like massive scale dining hall, stadium analysis kind of presentations that you were doing in consulting gave you a different perspective than the typical person coming to work at a restaurant?
It's interesting. I think I use a lot of more of those skills now than I did at the restaurant. I think it's like the restaurant was a separate piece of my like existence. It's like the consulting piece was my brain. When I was at the restaurant, it was truly taxing on like my body, like my physical being, like my feet, my back, like, and I'm like in pretty good shape. I also like teach yoga. I like love yoga. I'm like a very mindful person. And I've never felt like worse about my health than I did when I was working at a restaurant, my like stress and cortisol. So it was almost like I did both back to back. And I was like, okay, there's got to be something in between. There's got to be something that works the brain and that uses my hands and uses my body, but doesn't like deplete who I am and to a point where I can't show up and live your life, you know?
Right.
And, you know, a natural segue into the next chapter is COVID hit. And I still wanted to do something in the kitchen. I really like felt like I had a very unique palate. I felt like I could create incredible things, but I didn't like feeling like an imposter. I didn't like not having credibility or trust. And so I was like, okay, so I need to go to culinary school. That's like the natural thing that I need to do. So I went to culinary school, and with the, you know, my eyes set on being a recipe developer, either for like a Bon Appetit test kitchen type of thing or like a large food company like a Sweetgreen, a Chipotle, like some large company be part of their ethos and their mission. And this is also like the rise of Sweetgreen, the rise of QSR, which is a quick service restaurant. And I was infatuated by that space. I thought it was changing the way people eat. People were making healthier decisions, and I was really excited about that space. And so I went into culinary school really like with my eyes set on doing that and my sights set on doing that. And when I graduated, I pretty much immediately got a job doing that, which was like the dream. I like never thought in my wildest dreams that I was like, wait, did I actually just do the thing that I wanted to do? Like, I feel like I spent so much of my career really struggling and like, again, being unsatisfied. And so I started working for a company called Territory Foods, which was a ready-to-eat food company, similar to Factor. Factor is all ready-to-eat. It's a HelloFresh subsidiary where you don't have to make anything, right? Like the food arrives at your door, you pop it in the microwave or in the oven, and it's ready to go. So I managed our entire Northeast market. I did everything from recipe development, data science, and like created net promoter scores for all of our meals to make sure we were creating like incredible SKUs for people to enjoy. It was really the most amazing job. And what I didn't realize I was really doing was I was in a tech job. I thought I was deep in the food world, which I was. Obviously, it was awesome to be making recipes. But this was fully like a tech company. And that kind of took me a while to understand and to like get a pulse on like what I was actually doing and like what contacts and what network I was really a part of, which was cool.
I have two questions. One is, what was your favorite meal that you developed the recipe for at Territory Foods?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to need a moment to think about that. I think we had this basically like if I'm a huge Momofuku fan. I love the Momofuku restaurants. You know, they have since kind of like dissipated, and now Momofuku is more of a brand than it is a hospitality group, which I think has its own, I don't even want to like, but I think the restaurant, like if you're in the restaurant world, I think people are very opinionated on David Chang. They're very opinionated on the politics of Momofuku, which I'm not here to talk about. But I think in its prime, I think the restaurant group is incredibly talented. I think Major Domo in Los Angeles is one of my favorite restaurants. They do incredible stuff. And there's a dish called a bosom, which is a basically braised pork shoulder. It's actually not even braised. It's like slow roasted and cured. And you eat it with like shiso and kimchi on a lettuce wrap. And it's something that like you wouldn't think, like it sounds very complicated, but it's actually the most simple ingredients. It just takes a long time. It takes like a long time to cook. And I ended up putting that on the menu, like a version of this bosom that was just like an ode to this delicious thing that actually like is super simple and super kind of good for you. I mean, there's some like sugar and salt all over it, but besides that, yeah, it's just this like flavor combination explosion that I think you wouldn't expect to find in a ready to eat.
Yeah. No, that sounds great. So my second question, though, is it feels like from everything you've said up until this point, this is the top of the mountain, right? This is like recipe development. You're hands-on with the food. You're still working your brain in a way to make sure that, you know, things are totally getting to where they need to be. That realization that you were working in technology, how did that have an impact on your perspective on whether this was the actual top of the mountain that you had thought you were climbing versus, hey, maybe I'm one peak over because, you know, the medium in which I'm doing all these things isn't necessarily how I anticipated it to be.
Yeah, I think what was cool is that like it was still a startup. So I was still wearing all the hats, which was so cool for me. I really like was a key decision maker in my branch of the company. I handled all of our partnerships, all of our recipes, all of our SKUs. I was like responsible for people eating, essentially. And that's like what I truly wanted to do. I was definitely not being paid enough to do all of that, but it was an awesome experience. And I definitely felt like if I do this for, you know, 3 more years, I can do anything after this is how I felt. And I was like super comfortable, all felt really good. And then I think what happened after that is the company started to gain a lot of competition. Meal kits like Cook Unity, if you've heard of them, or Chef, S-H-E-F. There's a lot of competitors in this space, even what's now Wonder, which Wonder used to be like a food truck, basically, that created different SKUs of chef-based meals. And now they're like the fastest growing food tech company in the world, maybe even. I don't know what the actual statistic is there, so don't quote me. But a really rapidly moving company. And we were kind of falling behind. And that was very, very clear. We were making a lot of organizational decisions. And they ended up consolidating the entire New York market. It is now a completely different company. It's titled something else. And when I lost that job, I was laid off from that job. And my boss, who I still talk to today, was an incredible mentor and like helped me like endlessly. He was like, you're too good for this. You're going to find something. You're going to find something amazing. And I actually felt really empowered and excited. And I really thought from there, I think, as a young person, late 20s, like entering early 30s, that this was a really defining moment for me. I was like, this next job will be my future in the food industry, which is so not true. I think that was like such a scary lens that I decided to look through. But I was basically offered 2 jobs, one in a partnerships, like food adjacent role, and one as like the head of culinary ops at a QSR company in New York City. And one, the partnerships role was basically the role that I think when I was at consulting that I would have loved. I think like when I was leaving, you know, adjacent to food, young, early in at a company, and it felt a little like too immature for me. I felt like I could do more. And then the operations role, which felt a little over my head. But I was like, you know what? If I could do this, I could maybe start my own company one day. I could really like take this to new heights and continue on this path of what I'm doing. And I was there for not very long, realizing that startups are amazing and everyone should work at a startup at some point. I think you learn a lot, but there's a difference between like a scrappy startup and not having a job description. And I like truly didn't have a job description. And I think that really tarnished, like, you know, when you don't have a KPI, we don't have anything to report at the end of the day, it makes it a really tough work environment, both on yourself and both amongst your peers. I was paid pretty well to do this job that like basically had no outcomes, essentially. So I ended up leaving that job. I have a few mentors that work in the QSR space. So I have a mentor who worked at Sweetgreen for a very long time. I have a mentor who worked at Goop Kitchen. And I spoke to both of them and they were like, yeah, that didn't sound like the best place for you to be. And since then, I've kind of collected very intelligent people in both QSR, fine dining, and food tech. And I was like, okay, let's reevaluate. And from there, I kind of like had to make a new decision of what I was to do next.
Yeah. Do you think, before we get into your current job, Dana, I'm curious, because you've touched all of the different aspects of what I believe like food culture to be, which is you have the corporate old school kind of behind the scenes spreadsheet, very like large but important kind of role. You have the media outlet through your Bitches Who Brunch, you know, kind of side job of things that you are interested in, you know, just putting out into the world. You have working at an actual, you know, fine dining, roll your sleeves up, whatever job that needs to be done. And then you have like the QSR space and then also food tech, right? Which has got so big, especially now, I mean, technology in general, but like in the food space, it feels like it's very, it permeates a lot of what food culture is. I'm curious, do you think that from your perspective, that technology in food enables or hinders the food experience that, you know, the daily consumer has? It's a huge question, but I think you have a very unique perspective to give that answer.
Yeah, I think it begs the additional like layer of this question, which is like hardware versus software, right? So like, I think software has, we've all seen this transform over the last 8 years, which is like DoorDash, Uber Eats. The way that we interact with food decisions is the click of a button, which is crazy. And that's kind of like what we're already deep into. You know, we're beyond like scratching the surface. Where we've just scratched the surface, I think, is like, you know, Sweetgreen's diving into this world of like robots making your food on premise. And I think we're going to go deeper into that eventually. So I think it's interesting. I mean, I still like to, like, we ordered Chinese food last night. I still like to pick up the phone and call the restaurant and, you know, and there's an evolving technology piece to that too, of like bots that can now answer the phone and take your order, and that will evolve as well. So I don't know. I think there's parts of me that, you know, when convenience reigns supreme, technology saves my life, and technology, and I'm in awe of food technology. And then there are some times where you feel disconnected, you know, in a world where you can be connected to so much food. You can be, you can have Vietnamese food in 1 hour and Indian food the next hour, and, you know, really have anything you want, especially living in New York City. But I think you feel a little bit more disconnected from your food system. And going back to why I went into this industry, I would say that's the piece of me that like kind of looks back and is like, this isn't really what I set out to do. Like I really set out to like solve like more sustainable issues versus convenience related issues. Yeah, it's really like not a one size fits. We're only going to get deeper into it, for sure. I think there's a lot of things, especially like in entertainment, like they're predicting people will go back to the theater because they will crave live entertainment that forces you to put your cell phone away, you know, and it's more of like a forced decision, because people can't control themselves, right? At home, you can't control, you have to answer that text while you're watching your show. You know, why would you? Why would you not answer it? It's right there. And I think we'll have more experiences like that, like the RIP Frog Club, is that what it was called? Or that lasted,
right,
not even
where
a full
season.
Where they put
the phones in the holders.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, I think there, it's a shame that didn't work out. I think there's something to be desired there for sure. Not quite sure what's next though for it. In terms of the renaissance of of quiet time, for lack of a better description.
Some of the technology distances people, right? Like you said, where it's like you call somebody up and it's a robot on the phone, or you click a button and someone drops off a brown paper bag in front of your apartment. But some of it brings people closer together. And I think that's, what Table 22 is doing, especially because restaurants, shops, specialty stores, there's only so many touch points you could have with
Oh, yeah.
people. And I think loyalty is one of the things that is near and dear to my heart, just given my experience. But I think it's really cool how technology enables incremental touch points with people who have such an connection to, a restaurant or a shop or whatever, and they want to be able to interact more frequently than maybe is available to them. So can you talk a little bit, Dana, about what I think to be is like the shining light of food technology, which is like the loyalty programs and how you can, incentivize and enable that kind of connection and
Yeah.
what you do.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that is kind of a renaissance that we're seeing is people using technology to find out more information about their guests and to really be able to provide more hospitality. There's a great scene in The Bear where, if anyone's seen The Bear, it's about, a chef in Chicago and the grit behind it. But he overhears someone saying how they didn't get like Chicago style pizza while they were in town, and the server like runs out and gets them a slice of pizza to like give them as a takeaway goodie bag from their meal. And it's just that extra mile of hospitality. And I think that's where restaurants can really benefit from technology, because they're going to be able to really see a little bit deeper into the preferences of their guests, maybe before even the guest sees what they want or desire on their own. And so we're seeing this with companies like Blackbird. You're seeing it even on Resy and OpenTable, where you can now keep track of how many times a customer has been into your restaurant. There's all these ways to track who your guest is, why they dine with you, and what they even do when they dine with you, what they order, what if they get the same glass of wine every single time. It's really interesting. And what Table 22 does, high level, we help the best of the best restaurants, bars, merchants, producers, et cetera, create extra loyalty and community through a subscription service. So the most digestible example of that is a wine club. You walk into a wine shop, they say, "Hey, you come here all the time. You should really just join our wine club, like where we curate amazing things for you. It's really hands off. And when you join, you maybe get 10% off every purchase that you make. You get beautiful tasting notes, you get descriptions, and you're like, hell yeah, I want to be known by this wine shop because I'm an amazing guest. They should know who I am. They should give me the best service possible. But also, like, I deserve the curated amazing bottle that is being recommended of the month. That's what I want. Yes, of course." And so we take that model and we help bring that to some of the best restaurants, Michelin star, James Beard Award winning, specialty goods shops. So like cheeseries, butchers, bakeries, so that they can help tap into their community of customers that aren't shy to spend with them. A lot of time we saw this in the pandemic. There's tons of customers that want to spend more, but they just don't know how. They don't have an avenue. And when a customer, I mean, when a restaurant has like a drop or a pre-order or something extra that's like an introducing, like one day only, blah blah blah, it sells out like that, right? Like dinner series, winemaker dinners, collabs. I mean, I think now the collab world is almost too saturated, but
Sure.
I think there's a lot to be said for a restaurant that's doing more, and it's for the person who eats there the most.
Yeah.
So
No,
I'll pause
definitely.
there for a sec.
No, I think it's super interesting because I, as a consumer, but also, having worked in and around the food space myself, I like can recognize the value on both sides. And I think the big thing is making people feel special, right? Regardless of if they're consistent actual customers. Like I got an email from Fish Cheeks the other day to get a meal in a box thing, and we cooked it here. Like it's so, and I've been a couple times, but now I'm a fan for life because I got this kind of behind the scenes experience with the restaurant.
Exactly. And when you subscribe, you're kind of like pledging some sort of like allegiance to their brand. Like you're a part of their club, you're part of their community, and maybe you get first access to reservations. You know, maybe the chef comes out and says hello because they know how much you've spent with them. You know, you literally have a credit card on file and they're like, holy shit, Zach is, you know, this what is this kid doing? So it's cool to see the spend on these types of programs and how supportive people are for their restaurants. And on the restaurant side, I mean, some of our restaurants are bringing in seven figures just from this extra source of revenue, which is beyond service.
What makes a good loyalty program, would you say?
Yeah. A few things. I think high level, you know, on the customer side, there's three reasons why people want a subscription. One is like some sort of convenience factor. It gives you something that might be hard to find. That's a good example of like a butcher box. You know, it's these this box of beautiful cut meats from your local butcher that's pre-cut for you. They give you recipes for it. It arrives at your door. It's super easy to make. That's one. The next is curation. You know, the sommelier at Lutèce in Washington, D.C. is curating their favorite wines every single month for you to enjoy. It's highly selective, right? And then the third is exclusivity. It's this thing that you only get if you are a member. If your only members can receive this type of thing. And that's like the three core drivers to subscribe on the customer side. On the partner side, on the restaurant side, what makes a good subscription is obviously satisfying all of those things, but it's really having the trust of your customer. And obviously there's like all these other financial factors like disposable income, pricing the offering right, getting the offering right. But it's really about like the following and the trust. It's why we work with like Michelin star and James Beard award-winning restaurants because they've really earned the trust of their guests. It's why when you go on Resy, it's like sold out every single time, or you can't get a reservation, or you know, every time you click that summer series email to make, you know, to buy a ticket, you're too late, you know. All of those components that leave more to be desired are restaurants that are fit for a subscription program.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Dana, this was super, super interesting talking through your experience, talking through all the different aspects of the food world that you have touched throughout your career and then kind of the future of it with food tech. You said before you mentor a lot of people who are interested in getting into the food space, with or without the right intentions behind it, if they just want the nice aesthetic lifestyle or if they want to, you know, roll their sleeves up. But I'm curious, what advice would you give to someone who's interested in working in the food space, regardless of the medium in which they want to work?
Yeah, I think my advice would be try it. Try something. And I think this is advice that my mentor would probably be upset at me for giving. But, you know, I think we all want to be paid for our work. We always say, like, never give away free work. It's something I'm really bad at. Like, I help a lot of people and I give away too much of my time. But offering like a helping hand to just see if you like something, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think staging, volunteering, asking questions is like the best way to test if you like something. And you'll probably end up coming back to it time and time again. And at that point, you know, then you should definitely ask for a 1099 or something to be helping out. But I think, you know, it's not a bad idea to give a helping hand and to just offer your time. I think it's like the best thing that you could do.
Awesome. Great advice. Well, thank you so much, Dana. Appreciate your time and excited to share your story here.
Of course. Of course. Thanks. I hope it inspires somebody out there.